Chapter 3. On Saturday afternoon, Itali cut short a meeting with the author of what he thought of as the Indubitably pamphlet, alleging another obligation. "I have to see someone out in the country," he said abruptly. The author of the pamphlet, in awe of conspiracies, asked no questions. Itali left the house and walked straight down the street. He had no objective at all. Townhouses gave place to villas set back behind low walls. Villas gave place to farmhouses and open fields, and paving blocks of the street to the red dirt of a country road. Overhead stretched a wide, changeable April sky, reflected underfoot in long puddles left from the morning's rain. Weeds bloomed, coarse and timid, by the fences. Grain and grass were bright green on the ploughlands. The road, very long and straight, the Roman road that had crossed the western province to the garrison at Aquae Nervi, was empty. The fields were empty, except for a lone ploughman who silently answered Itali's silent salutation from the road. It was a gentle land, monotonous, noble in its coherent and unbroken vastness from horizon to horizon. Itali walked straight on, vaguely contented by the fresh wind and the rough road under his feet, noticing more clearly, from time to time, a wild iris, a cloud shadow fading across a field, a lark playing in the high air, a rain-washed stone. In 4 days, he would be back to Krasnoy. His mind revolved perpetually about the end of that trip. What would he do? What should he do? He was sick of thinking about it, and never ceased to think about it. How had he let himself be involved in an unsuitable, an impossible affair like this? A marriageable heiress, a spectacular woman, who could not possibly manage to have a lover without her brother and probably half a dozen of her suitors finding out about it. And if they did not, she might very well tell them, for she was nervous, capricious, insanely willful, spoilt. A spoilt girl. A proud, sensitive, frightened girl. A woman risking herself, offering him everything and asking nothing in return. Nothing but that his courage equal hers. It was freedom she wanted, liberty. What did all his work for liberty amount to? 2 rooms on Manana Strada, an irregularly published journal of very uneven quality, a succession of jobs taken to keep the rent paid, a circle of feckless and unstable acquaintances, all professing devotion to the cause, but quarrelling about it continually. And was this to be his life? Was this what he had left Malafrena for? For a liberal, the means justify the end. To attain freedom, one must live. Live free. It was freedom she wanted, freedom she offered. And he was already so lost among contingencies, petty considerations, and conventional moralities, that he could consider rejecting that offer. Was he a man or not? Not yet, maybe. He had been a boy until now. He had come at last into his majority. He was, and would be, a man. But which man? A hand-to-mouth radical journalist, or a baroness's lover? Why could he not be both? Was he supposed to live celibate for the cause of liberty? Was it a religion, and he its holy hypocrite? He strode through the bright fields of afternoon in a rage, sometimes waving his right arm as he argued fiercely with himself. And all the while he knew in the centre of his heart that he might or might not go to Luisa Paludeska when he returned to Krasnoy, but that it was not reason that would or could make the choice. Reasons abounded, but within him something single, whole, indifferent, waited for a sign. The road led up and over one of the long, low rises of land that made up the immense level of the plain. So gradual was the ascent that slope and summit were all one. Itali stopped and looked back. Eisner lay 5 or 6 miles away, made entire by distance. Tile roofs red in the declining light, the calm towers of the cathedral rising above blue shadow. Near where he stood was the ruin of a hut, a few stones and rain-rotted planks. He sat down there, on what had been a doorstep or a hearthstone, between the city and the sun. The blowing of the country wind had finally blown his thoughts away. For a long time, he sat hearing only the wind in the new grass. He sought stillness of heart, the void, the gap, the silence that had been his kingdom in the sunlit afternoons of the years at Malafrena. That was liberty, but it was gone. He had lost it. He turned to look southward. The same long plains ran varied and changeless as the sea to a soft haze on the horizon. What would you do if you had 700 years to live? There they were, Laura in a glimmering white dress, Piera and himself on the terrace in late midsummer dusk, the hunter standing dark across the blurred and shining lake. He said he would travel to China and America. Laura wanted volcanoes. And Piera, what was it she had wanted to do? But what the devil, Piera was in Eisner. She was not there, in a remembered dusk above the lake, any more than he was. She was here, under one of those red tile roofs, in some convent school. The Belenin he had met at the Marchioness's house was her cousin. Itali stood up, stretched, and started back to town. He could not stay in the same town with Piera Voltaska for 2 weeks and leave without a sign to her. Things weren't that bad yet with him yet. At about 5, he was at the Belenin's front door. "The Countess is not here today, sir," said the old servant, polite, but mistrustful of the dusty stranger. Itali asked where he might find her. "The Countess lives in the Ursuline school, sir, on the old side, facing the ring fountain." The Countess, the Countess. Young Piera, with freckles on her neck. Itali marched off across Fontomana Street to the ring fountain. There was a big, tight-lipped building with barred windows. A porter opened to his knock and said there were no visiting hours on Easter Eve. Come next Saturday. Itali pleaded the fact that he must leave on Wednesday, and his right hand put a small silver piece in the porter's without his left hand knowing a thing about it. He was shown into an icy parlour containing 4 straight-back chairs and 1 nun. He pleaded with the nun. An older nun was called, and he pleaded with her, eloquently tactful. He was, as he had been since he got to his feet, in the ruined hut on the hill, determined. The second nun went away. The first retired to a chair in the hall just outside the open door, and Piera came in. "Oh, Itali," she said. And they put their arms round each other and kissed each other on the mouth. "Oh, my dear Itali," she said, tears in her eyes, laughing, in the first great flash of joy that ran through both of them. And then they dropped their arms and did not know what to do with them. "My God, How did I even know you? He said, still dazzled by the flash, and she laughed again. Don't swear here. I've grown 2 inches nearly. It's like coming home to see you, Piera. I know. To see you, too. And you still talk, Malafren. Come and sit down. We don't have to stand. Her last words were conventionally gracious. Chill grew where the bright warmth had been. Itali sat down on one of the rigid chairs. I can't sit down, he said, standing up once again. And Piera giggled. The last flare. It went out. It's very strange to see you here, he said, looking about the room, his hands behind his back. I know. 4 walls, 4 chairs, 2 doors. He had to look back at her. How long have you been in Aesna? 10 days. I should have come before. I've been seeing a lot of people. Time gets away. Sorry I caused all this regulation breaking. Anything rather than not seeing you at all. Do you like it here? Yes, it's very nice. When will you go home? I'll leave here in June and stay with the Belenins for a while, she said. Her voice was hesitant. She stood hesitant yet calm in her sleek grey dress and white apron. Will you not tell anyone? I mean, write to them, please, Itali, because there hasn't been time yet for Papa's letter to come. My letter went on the last post. I wanted to tell you. I won't be going home exactly, either. I'm going to live in Aesna. I'm engaged to be married, this coming winter, or perhaps after Easter next year. I see. I'm very glad for you, he said, with a prolonged stammer. Who is? Jivan Koste. He's a lawyer. Do you know the Belenins? They've been so kind to me. I'm so fond of them. He's a friend of theirs. It's all going to be as quiet as can be, since he's a widower with a little boy. He did not remember her voice being so thin, or so sweetly modulated, a young lady voice. I'm very fond of him, of Baptiste, she said. That was very nice. Everything was nice. Everyone was kind and fond. Why was she telling him all this? Let her get on with it and marry her damned widower. What was it to him? I suppose that's the end of it, he said. Of what, Itali? He waved his arm. Knowing each other? The part of life when we knew each other. It doesn't have to be, she said in that thin voice. If you came to Aesna, I hope you'd come to see me and we might be at Malafrena again, at Summers. But we've left Malafrena, he said. It's taken me a while to learn that. Life's not a room, it's a road. What you leave and it's lost. You can't turn back. That's how it is. We most likely won't meet again. Perhaps not, she said. There was a considerable pause. Are you happy in Krasnoy? She asked. Happy? No, not particularly, I suppose. I'm doing what I went to do there. I see your journal sometimes. Well, they let you read seditious papers here. He looked about with a hard grin at the walls and doors. Not here. Your articles are very interesting. Why the situation of linen weavers in Krasnoy slums should be interesting to you, I don't know, but thanks. He had heard the valour in her tone. He heard the hypocrisy in his own. He could endure no more. I must go now, Piera, he said flatly. She turned towards him. Goodbye, he said. And she took his hand and said, Goodbye, Itali. That was that. Outside, by the double-tiered, silver-stranded ring fountain, he looked at his watch. It said 2:30, as usual. But the cathedral bell had just struck. It must be 6. He was late for an appointment he had made with two likely contributors to Novesma Verba. He set off hastily to the cafe where they were to meet. "Life's a road," he heard his voice saying, fatuously, fraudulently. "Life's not a room, it's a road." Yes, sure enough, a road going nowhere, on and on, meaningless. No turning back, no stopping, no end, no goal. Best to go alone, allowing no claims. Let the dead bury their dead. The two men he met at the cafe were young. One an ex-seminarian, the other an unsuccessful candidate for representative to the National Assembly, which was to be convened this September in Krasnoy. Itali's unmoved familiarity with their hopes and questions left them impressed and admiring. He saw that, and grew still more dry and hard in his replies, but they would not be discouraged. He left them as soon as he could, and went to the hotel to which he had moved when the Paliudeskas left. He had a chop sent up to his room, and went through the last few days' notes and papers. His fortnight in Iznar was proving profitable. There was money here for the support of both journals. There were contributors of talent, and the prosperous middle class of the city followed the liberal tradition established in the last century. It was all very encouraging. Drearily, he got his work in order. At the dinner he'd allowed to get cold, sat down again to work. One had to go alone. No use looking for anything one had left behind. Take what happiness might come. Get the work done, and no complaining. It was the only way, alone. To be free, one had to be alone. He was getting a headache, and to shake it off, he went out around 11 to walk. As he went down Fontomana Street, all black dappled with shadows of branches cast by lighted windows, alive with the night wind and a quiet coming and going of people, someone hailed him from a cafe table. The Italian exile, San Giusto. "Have a coffee with me, Sorde." Itali stopped by the table, but did not sit down. "I was thinking of looking in the cathedral." "Ah, it's Easter. I'll come, you don't mind. My bill, please, 5 coffees." They went on together. "On Monday I leave to go to England," said San Giusto. "Now, I don't want to go. I speak the language better, but I like your country. I like Krasnoy. I like this Iznar. I don't know why I go to England." He laughed, showing his strong white teeth. "Only at times it's good to get out from the Empire, huh? But I shall come back, I think. I hope they'll let you in, after we've published your articles from England." "Oh, here I'm even more insignificant than in my country. And your police are not so good as those in the Piedmont. But I shall not stop in Vienna to obtain permission." "What if we use a false name on your articles?" "Why not? I have been Carlo Franceschi in Turin already." "You look tired, Sordi." "I am. And I am full of coffee, like a ship that's sinking. Every night I drink coffee. What else to do?" He laughed again. "What a life. Look at the poor devils. They want to be home in their Bohemia, or where they come from." They had passed a pair of militiamen, imposing in the imperial uniform. "Like all of us. Easter night, we would go to mass in the boat across the lake." "What lake?" "Lago d'Orta," San Giusto said, lingering on the name with conscious love, saying it with pleasure, tenderness. They approached the doors of the cathedral, which stood open, showing a glimpse of dusk and gold within. A little procession was crossing the cathedral square, coming from Old Side. Nuns and girls, heavily shawled. Itali recognized the grey uniform Piera had worn. She was among the tall girls at the end of the line, no doubt, head bent submissively as she walked. She would not see him, nor could he tell which of the slender, shawled figures she might be. "Pretty ducklings," said San Giusto. "I see them take their walk in the afternoon, so neat, with bright eyes, seeing everything like telescopes. I like the girls of convent schools. They always know so much. Excuse me, you feel religious?" It made Itali laugh. "No," he said. "I should like to see your mountains, where you come from. As you spoke of them yesterday, I thought this sounds like my country." "I wish I could take you there, San Giusto." "Oh, well, the time will come. If you wait, the time comes, I find. To learn how to wait, that's the job for the exile, isn't it? I will remember your invitation, Sordi, thank you. Come on, the mass begins." They went into the church, into the grieving, the waiting, the fulfillment of Easter night. "Christ is risen," the choir sang, the music like sunrise in the heart of night. "Christ is risen in glory." And the joy washed over Itali's heart, like rain on a stone of the roads, like sunlight over stone.